The first time she saw Ciarán at that Dublin Art Gallery in April 2012, something about him was different. Beyond his exceptional beauty, his downy, darkening blonde hair, large gray eyes, and perfect cherubic mouth, there was an immense stillness radiating from his body, a self-containment that seemed otherworldly amid the social chaos. Her reaction transcended mere attraction. It was grave and troubling pity, an intense tenderness for his human condition. He became the first man she worshipped, his body a site of prayer. This immediate elevation foreshadowed the unhealthy dynamic to come. Their first conversation revealed fundamental differences. Discussing art, she admitted uncertainty, while he found freedom in art's lack of fixed meaning. Before leaving, Ciarán gave her his nearly full beer, asked her to walk with him tomorrow, and wrote his number on a napkin, small gestures that took on enormous significance in her mind. Her life before him was fractured, happy in public, but tormented in private. Having abandoned religion after childhood, she had cultivated a great faith in love instead, seeing it as the force that would set ablaze the fields of my life in one go and make her worthy through its presence. Despite an awkward first date at the Natural History Museum, she realized she was already in love with him, and there wasn't a thing he or anybody else could do to change it. As their relationship developed, warning signs emerged that she willfully ignored. Ciarán revealed an angry side, becoming furious at perceived slights from strangers and ranting about people who offended him. Rather than seeing this as concerning, she found his venting oddly bonding. A pivotal moment came at a reading where her friends performed, their first public appearance as a couple. Ciarán remained visibly displeased throughout, silent, avoiding eye contact, wearing an expression of disdain. When confronted, he dismissed the event as shit and stated her friends weren't his. When she cried, he delivered the crushing line, "Did you want me to say I'm falling in love with you? Because I'm not." Days later, he apologized, blaming his ex, Freyja, who had cheated on him, yet confessed, "The best times of my life were with Freyja." She silently vowed to rebuild his trust, setting herself up to forever compete with a ghost. By November, she had compartmentalized her relationship with Ciarán, introducing him only at brief public gatherings. Their dynamic improved as his sullenness faded, and she measured their progress by seasons. "We had passed two whole seasons together and were making good headway on the next." This illusion shattered when Ciarán mentioned poems he was writing about Freyja. Learning he'd sent them to Freyja for feedback devastated her, as did discovering their intimate Norwegian past through Freyja's email. Despite this betrayal, Ciarán grew gentler, buying flowers and taking her to dinner. His pre-Christmas gift of an amber brooch with a note, "You are a beautiful woman and I love you," restored her faith. After a Christmas breakup when Ciarán disappeared, they reconciled 3 months later and moved in together. Even now, I think if I could have lived just in those moments, no friends, family, or work intruding, with our bodies welded together in that cold bed, I might still be happy there. Her desperation to please Ciarán manifested as domestic servitude. She cooked meals he ate without thanks, washed his smoke-stained clothes, and scrubbed toilets, finding these tasks sexy, intimate, even profound rather than demeaning. This self-erasure was strategic. "If he got something from me, I was taking something too, making him unable to live without me by subsidizing his rent, cooking his food, cleaning his clothes, until he couldn't remember life before me." Her servitude was both submission and control, creating dependency she hoped would secure his love. By June, she began seeing women through Ciarán's eyes, first together, then alone. She scanned for women he would find attractive, those with delicate features, dreamy eyes, suggestions of frailty, long hair, prominent collarbones. She collected these mental images as protection against threats. Her obsession with Freyja intensified when Ciarán called his ex after a terrorist attack in Malmö, leading her to check Freja's social media daily, comparing their photos together. Ciaran's control expanded beyond their relationship. He criticized her drinking, transportation choices, and dental habits, once forcing her to examine bloody spit, declaring, "That's disease. That's what happens when you don't floss." He suggested veganism, like Freja, and limited drinking and smoking to once weekly. In response, she drank more in his presence while maintaining composure. When he poured her wine down the sink, she feigned agreement while secretly delighting in his self-sabotage. She began drinking before he arrived home. Her desire for Ciaran vanished. Though his body remained beautiful, his touch barely registered. She performed passion convincingly, faking orgasms he couldn't distinguish from real ones, leaving her both proud and frightened by her isolation. When Ciaran forgot to log out of her computer, she discovered his emails to Freja. Reading through them obsessively, she hoped to find betrayal. Instead, she found something worse: mundanity. Their correspondence revealed two dependent people unable to imagine different lives. The breaking point came during her father's hospitalization. Confronting his mortality, she reconnected with Ruben, her first love. Their intimacy felt like being with a wonderful ghost, touching familiar places and discovering new ones that still felt known. Unlike with Ciaran, sex with Ruben was soft, easy, almost funny, rather than desperate and anguished. After her father recovered, she began calculated infidelities. At a party, she met Noah, whose warmth contrasted with Ciaran's freeze. Noah shared freely without expectation, making her feel funny and new and fizzing. As her marriage crumbled, she embraced chaos. Her drinking intensified, while her behavior toward Ciaran oscillated between excessive sweetness and complete absence. She reunited with dedicated drunks and chronically depressed artists and musicians living on welfare who maintained her former lifestyle. On her 25th birthday, she realized her good times with Ciaran were merely relief from his hatred. She had transformed suffering into something she considered worthwhile. When attempting to break up, Ciaran mockingly read her diaries aloud, exposing her affairs, feelings about Noah, and her written desires to be hurt, before initiating violent sex, sneering, "This is what you like." After this final violation, she fled to a hotel and later spent 6 months in Greece, where loneliness had transformed into something more permanent and peaceful, something that could be endured forever. The novel concludes with her finding happiness in simple things: elderly twins sunbathing, her beer in the sand, sour cigarettes. She remembered loving learning for itself, not to impress others. Now she was right inside my life with nobody to say what happened next. This unflinching portrayal shows that surrendering your identity, hoping someone else will make you whole, is perhaps the most desperate act. True liberation comes from recognizing your inherent completeness, even in brokenness.